An overwhelming number of public workers in Iowa have voted to maintain their union affiliation. So what's the future of organized labor in the state? It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Also this hour, what now after Iowa drops a stopgap health insurance proposal? A judge reverses the Muscatine City Council's removal of their mayor. The Iowa Supreme Court puts on hold a new Iowa law requiring a 3-day waiting period for an abortion. And a high school homecoming king returns to school after collapsing due to a cardiac arrest at a football game. Buckle up for your News Buzz. First, this news from NPR.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, in voting that ended this week, public sector workers across Iowa endorsed their union representation by a wide margin. It was voting that was mandated by Iowa's new collective bargaining law. Joining us to talk about it, Joyce Russell, IPR Statehouse correspondent. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, Ben.
Can we back up to what happened in the 2017 legislative session, a session that was marked by the first government unified under Republican control, both chambers and the governor's office in GOP hands. In two decades, we had this flurry of new laws under the Republicans, one of which set out to reshape organized labor in the public sector? Remind us what this law mandated.
Well, it sharply reduced the rights of public employees to bargain for benefits. And a couple of the most controversial things, it significantly scaled back the number of things that workers can bargain for. But the thing that was important this week is that it also required recertification votes for local bargaining units. And this was, when the union folks criticized this bill as union busting, this was one of the things that they pointed to under the old collective bargaining law. A group of public workers can say, we want to have a bargaining unit, we want to collectively bargain, they have a certification vote, and then that just stands until somebody doesn't want to be certified anymore, and then you can call for a recertification vote. But this bill requires a recertification vote before every new contract period. That's roughly every 2 to 3 years. Mm-hmm. So
this week we had the results of the first go round, so to speak, and by and large, the union locals across the state renewed their unions, right?
That's right. It was actually the second round. The first round involved 13 school districts, and in those, 100% of those, the teachers voted to remain union, keep their union representation. That was sort of the starter, kind of a prep for this one, which was thousands of workers casting their ballots, and 86% of the workers who voted to keep their union representation. Only 2% voted against it. However, under this law, which one of the most controversial parts of this is that you had to have a majority of all the people who could vote, not just all the people who did vote.
Right. So unlike a real election or an election that we know, where you just count the people who voted, the non-voters were no's.
That's right. And 12% of the eligible voters didn't vote. And in 32 instances, 32 bargaining units, the majority of those who voted wanted to keep their union, but there were enough people not voting that those votes failed.
Interesting. Okay, what about the minority, that small minority? What was it, 32 union locals?
Uh-huh.
Their contracts dissolved?
That's right.
Right? And so do they have a chance to renew that in the future sometime?
By law, by the terms of this law, they have to wait for 2 years.
Okay, no appeal or anything like that?
Well, there are some of this voting is being appealed. There was one AFSCME unit that there was a voided ballot, and AFSCME is challenging that. So there's a 30-day period for appealing. I don't see a lot of that happening.
So, Joyce, you mentioned union busting, the charge made by the Democrats here. How does the Republican Party counter that charge?
Well, in the arguments on the bill, although I have to say, in the arguments on the bill, it was mostly Democrats arguing against this bill. There wasn't very much said that in favor of it by Republicans, but they did say that unions should be held accountable to their members. We should keep in mind that it isn't just the union members who were involved in this. Everybody in the bargaining unit was involved in this, and it had to be 50% plus one of all of those people in the bargaining unit, not just the union members.
Mm-hmm. Was this vote a surprise to anyone? Did people expect fewer unions to make it through?
Well, I think it was just such an unknown. People didn't know what to expect. And the first round, it was all schools. It was all teachers' unions, bargaining units that were voting. And the Iowa State Education Association had a big effort to make sure everybody understood what this was all about. And they were 100% successful in that. And of course, so the union leaders were quite nervous about this in the second round. Thousands of workers were involved, hundreds of bargaining units. AFSCME is the biggest public employees union, and their leader, Danny Homan, his response was, "I'm ecstatic by this result."
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because it's often been said in the past when this we've talked about this during the legislative session that Iowa was sort of walking the path that, say, our neighbor Wisconsin has already walked with the consequences they have up in Wisconsin. But does this tell us anything if we are indeed following Wisconsin in terms of weaker unions?
Well, I think that remains to be seen. I think this vote this week, I not only was it an endorsement of the unions, but I think it was, some people are arguing, and I think there's some truth to this, that it was actually, it ended up as a strengthening tool for the unions. I mean, they were reaching out to all of their members, making sure they knew what was at stake, making sure they knew what it was that the Republican legislature was doing to them, or, you know, you might say for them, but the union's argument is this is what the Republican legislature is doing to you.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that the unions are hoping that it will actually be a strengthening tool, and they're, of course, going to go after this very, very hard in the 2018 legislative races.
Joyce Russell, Iowa Public Radio State House correspondent, thanks for the explainer on that vote. In a vote ending this week, public sector workers across Iowa, to repeat, to endorse their union representation by a wide margin. Joyce, thanks so much.
Okay, thanks, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law will be along to tell us about a hold that's been put on a new Iowa law requiring a 3-day waiting period for an abortion. Also, Sarah Ritter of the Quad City Times will talk about how this past week a district court judge ruled that the city council in Muscatine should not have removed its mayor. It was a violation of her right to due process. We'll hear those stories in just a moment. But first, a couple of prominent health stories in the news in Iowa this week. Let's check in with Tony Lays, Des Moines Register health reporter. Hi, Tony.
Hi, Ben.
So Iowa Insurance Commissioner Doug Ullman, he's been on this program a couple of times in the past months to explain his stopgap insurance proposal to shore up Iowa's, I guess you'd say, teetering Obamacare insurance, these exchange markets. This week, Ullman and Governor Kim Reynolds announced the state's plans to withdraw the proposal. So remind us, what were they asking Washington to remedy and how?
What they were doing, it's pretty complicated. It's kind of a Rube Goldberg thing, but the gist is they were asking for permission to redirect subsidies under the Affordable Care Act in several ways. One would be to allow folks over the 400% of poverty level, which is about $48,000 for a single person, to get some subsidy to help pay their premium. Right now, folks like that don't get any help. And the other thing is they were going to help insurance carriers shoulder the burden of people who use more than $100,000 worth of health care in a year. And the idea was to limit premiums to the point where more young, healthy people would sign up for insurance instead of just older and sicker people.
Mm-hmm. So tinkering with the Affordable Care Act in some way. Now, what has been the response from Washington with this proposal?
Well, the proposal was first made in June when it looked like Iowa might not have any carriers selling individual health insurance. And first of all, that's really important to note. This is just for folks who buy their own insurance instead of getting it through an employer or through Medicare or Medicaid.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, it looked like Iowa wasn't going to have any carriers for that kind of insurance, and people wouldn't have any choices. So the state started coming up with this plan. Then one carrier said it would stay in the market, but was going to need about a 57% premium increase. So Iowa went ahead with the plan.
Mm-hmm.
And they submitted it to the feds and waited and waited and waited. And they finally just couldn't wait anymore.
What forced their hand?
Sign-ups start November 1st, which is next week. There's only 6 weeks for people to sign up for this coverage for next year. And they just had to get going. So they're going ahead with the Affordable Care Act plans.
I understand some in Washington are blaming, or also here perhaps Republicans, blaming the Affordable Care Act for not allowing them to be, what, flexible enough to be creative with this sort of fix? Is that a fair criticism?
They're pointing the finger. Well, it's not for me to say what's fair. It's certainly a criticism. That's what the Republicans are saying. The Democrats are saying, look, this was proposed by a Republican insurance commissioner, and it was supported by Republican leaders of Iowa, and it was turned down by a Republican administration. But the Republicans say our hands are tied by the Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm. So how many Iowans does this potentially impact going forward?
Well, there's 72,000 people in this market, but it's important to note that 50,000 of those or so are sheltered because they get subsidies under the Affordable Care Act, and those subsidies increase as their premiums increase. So they should be all right. They'll be able to buy insurance from Medica. The other 20,000 or so are going to face huge premium increases for next year, and the insurance commissioner is predicting that a lot of them will just go without coverage.
Mm-hmm. So, Tony, of course, since this new administration took office, we've been having two versions of what we're being told. The failed repeal and replace effort, of course, the backdrop there. One version, Republicans saying that Obamacare is collapsing under its own weight. The other version by the Democrats, it's sabotage, what the new administration is doing, and that the ACA is having the legs kicked out from under it. Is there one that's closer to the truth than the other?
Well, the ACA is a very complicated thing, and there have been problems implementing parts of it, for sure, especially in places like Iowa without a lot of insurance choices. It's also true that the Republicans really want to get rid of it, and the Trump administration has not been doing a lot to try to make the law work better because they want to get rid of it.
Mm-hmm. The president himself has made no bones about sort of gleefully saying it's imploding or exploding, whatever expression he uses.
He has said that let's let it implode and the Democrats will come to the table and help us come up with something else.
Okay. Well, that brings us to, you know, this bipartisan solution, the so-called Alexander Murray bill, talking with Joni Ernst, our Senator Ernst, earlier this week. She says she's backing the bipartisan deal in Congress, a Senate bill that would give states more flexibility to alter Obamacare rules. Does that look likely from your perspective, Tony?
It could be. The question is, can they get it done fast enough to help people for 2018? And that's hard to see how they could do that because the sign-up period is only 6 weeks starting next week. I think at this point, Iowa is going to have to go forward with what's available, which is just one carrier with big premium increases
mm-hmm.
for this group of people.
Tony Lays of the Des Moines Register, let's talk about another issue that you covered, health issue here in Iowa this week that you wrote about. A more local story, frustration, residents waiting for action on an abandoned VA hospital in Knoxville. This is interesting. A little video story here. You interviewed the mayor of Knoxville. Give us some background here. This is a huge facility that many Iowans don't even know about.
It's really huge, and it's right as you drive into town from the west. And when you walk the grounds, you get a sense of how big it is. It's 39 buildings, most of them pretty big, brick buildings, 151 acres. It's about 5% of the property in Knoxville. They decided in 2014 to close it and it took several years to actually move all the services, mostly to Des Moines VA. But they had assured the town at the time that they would help them find another use for this campus, and it has not happened. And they've been mowing the grass and plowing the snow, but that's about it. And the buildings, they look all right from the outside, but reportedly they're just falling apart inside.
Mm-hmm. Any prospects on the horizon for taking over this huge, almost campus-like area?
Well, they had a town hall meeting last month, and the city says the VA has been better at communicating over the last year or so than they were for several years. They brought in some specialists from the federal government who go around the country disposing of surplus property, and they said, we will find a buyer or several buyers for this, we promise. There's some concern because the specialist told this town hall meeting that the government is not interested in tearing down the properties. They want to sell it as is, or tearing down the buildings. They want to sell it as is. And some folks in the town wonder who would want to buy that and then take on the responsibility of these old buildings.
Mm-hmm. Tony Lay's reporting on how residents in the Knoxville area waiting for action on an abandoned VA hospital there. Tony Lay's, thanks for keeping us up to date on a couple of health stories this week in the state. Tony, thanks.
Thanks for the opportunity, Ben.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Now to a couple of interesting developments this week at the Iowa Supreme Court. Joining us to explain that a bit, Todd Pettis, law professor and the H. Blair and Joan V. White Chair in Civil Litigation at the University of Iowa College of Law. Todd, thanks for coming in out of the cold and explaining these couple of things for us. First, the enforcement of a new Iowa law requiring a 3-day waiting period for an abortion remaining on hold, the state Supreme Court has decided. Give us some background here.
Well, this is legislation that Terry Branstad, just a few weeks before he left us to be ambassador to China. This is a law that he signed into effect in early May. And this law would have gone into effect immediately under the terms of the law itself had it not been put on hold by the courts while litigation goes on. And so, in the month since May, the Iowa Supreme Court said first that we're going to hold off on enforcing this law while the district court can hold a trial and examine the merits of the constitutional challenges that Planned Parenthood has brought against it. That court has now ruled at the end of September and has found the law permissible. And the Iowa Supreme Court has now renewed the hold on the law's enforcement while the Iowa Supreme Court can take a look at it. And what the law says, it says a number of things, but what's really the focus here in this litigation is this 72-hour waiting period. Mm-hmm. The woman who wants to obtain an abortion has to make two trips. On the first trip, she has to go in, has to have an ultrasound. She has to be given an opportunity to see the ultrasound. She has to be given an opportunity to hear the heartbeat. She has to be advised of all alternatives to abortion. There's a range of things that have to happen at that first meeting, and then at least 72 hours have to pass. She comes back then for a second appointment. It's only after at that second appointment that the abortion is authorized. And the question is whether that is placing too much of a constraint or too much of a restriction on the woman's constitutional freedom to obtain an abortion.
Especially women who might not be in a position to do all that traveling and those expenses incurred.
Exactly. That's where the burdens of the law would fall heaviest, of course. In two-thirds of Iowa's counties, for example, there are no OBGYNs practicing. And so women who live in rural counties have to travel further for a lot of this care. And so it does place a burden. And we use that word burden. That's actually the right term to use here because under the federal constitution, and then there's two constitutions here at issue. There's the federal constitution mm-hmm. and the Iowa constitution. Under the federal constitution, the question is, does this law pose an undue burden? It's okay to pose a burden. It's okay if it makes it a little more inconvenient, but is it an undue burden? And the Supreme Court has said, now, when we say undue burden, what we mean is this a substantial obstacle? It's okay if it's an obstacle. It's okay if it makes it a little bit harder, but is it a substantial obstacle? And the Iowa District Court has ruled, the trial level court has ruled, that it's not a substantial obstacle. Yes, it will make it a little harder, it'll make it inconvenient, but it's not a substantial obstacle. And so one issue in front of the Iowa Supreme Court will be, is that ruling right? Is it a substantial obstacle? The second issue, and this could, depending on how the case comes out, this could be one of the real headlines from the ruling, is does the Iowa Constitution provide more protection for the woman than the federal Constitution does? Okay. Under Roe versus Wade, the famous federal Supreme Court case that was decided in 1973, under Roe versus Wade, this 72-hour waiting period would plainly be unconstitutional because under Roe versus Wade, as it was originally decided, the state couldn't put any obstacles or any burdens on the woman in the early months of a pregnancy. Well, that changed in Planned Parenthood versus Casey, another famous federal Supreme Court ruling on abortion, and that's where we got the undue burden standard. Well, one issue in front of the Iowa Supreme Court will be, well, under the Iowa Constitution, which of those two tests, if either of them, is what the Iowa Constitution demands? Does the Iowa Constitution give Roe versus Wade-like protections where the state really has to stay out early in the pregnancy, can't impose things like waiting periods? Or does the Iowa Constitution provide something less?
Mm-hmm. Has the Iowa Supreme Court ever decided such a case like this?
They never have. We had, you know, people may remember the telemedicine abortion case from just a couple years ago where doctors would remotely have a video encounter with a woman but would not be there in person. And the Iowa Supreme Court struck down a state law that restricted that practice. But in that case, the Iowa Supreme Court said, the state concedes that the Iowa Constitution gives a certain degree of protection, and under that amount of protection, this law is not permissible. The Iowa Supreme Court has never been pushed to say, okay, we've got a law in front of us, and it's valid under federal law, but is it possible that the state law provides even more protection? They've never decided that.
In the 2 minutes we have remaining, tell us about the news yesterday that the Iowa Chief Justice Mark Cady issued an order for Iowa courts to banning the use, the routine use of restraints on juveniles during court proceedings. What's the thinking behind that? Up to this point, you could put a juvenile in shackles just as an adult, as a matter of rule.
Yes, and I think it happened quite routinely. And the process would be the child we brought into the courtroom would be physically confined, wearing shackles, handcuffs, etc. And if the child's attorney wanted those removed, they would then have a conversation with the judge saying, you know, that there's no flight risk, there's no risk of harm, can we remove these restraints? The real heart, I think, of this new rule is, first of all, there's a presumption that the child should not be restrained. And so if restraints are going to be put on, it's going to be because the state has made an argument that in this case, the child does pose a serious flight risk or a risk of harm to himself or herself, okay? And then second, we got to have those conversations before the child's even brought to the courtroom, all right? So if we know a court proceeding is coming, if the child's going to be constrained, we had to have that conversation and justify it beforehand. So
and the thinking here is, too, do it on a case-by-case and don't add harm to a situation that has arisen and perhaps impact this child for a lifetime.
Exactly. The Iowa Supreme Court in particular has done a lot of thinking in the last decade or so, or even less than that, about juveniles, juvenile offenders, how they're different, brains are different, impacts on them are different. And I see this kind of loosely as being of a piece with that thinking. We don't have time to talk about it now, but juvenile sentencing and so forth, where the Iowa Supreme Court has made a lot of law recently.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Todd Pettis of the University of Iowa College of Law, thanks for stepping into the studio to update us on some news out of the Iowa Supreme Court this week, Todd.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Coming up in just a moment after a short break, when we return with this NewsBuzz edition of River to River, we'll find out about how a judge reversed the Muscatine City Council's removal of their mayor. Also, I'll talk with a University of Iowa physician and scientist who testified in Washington this week. And a high school homecoming king returns to school after collapsing due to a cardiac arrest at a football game. River to River's News Buzz continues. I'm Ben Kiefer, back after a short break.
Support for IPR and this podcast comes from Luther College, offering more than 60 areas of study, including the new data science and neuroscience majors, dedicated to preparing students for success in a changing world.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Coming up in just a few minutes, I'll talk with a University of Iowa physician and scientist who took part this week in two congressional briefings. We'll talk about that in just a moment. But first, in May, the city council in Muscatine voted unanimously to remove that city's mayor from office. Well, this past week, though, a district court judge ruled that the city council's removal of that mayor, Diana Broderson, from office last May was a violation of her right to due process. Joining us now with this story, a story I understand that pitted neighbor against neighbor, Sarah Ritter of the Quad City Times. Hi, Sarah.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Thanks for being on. You write that almost immediately after the mayor, Mayor Broderson, was elected and took office, there were problems. What kind of problems?
Yeah, so she took office in January 2016. It was really that January, by the end of the month and end of February, that the council started having problems with her. The role of mayor in Muscatine is not that powerful. Really, kind of one of the main powers is that she has the ability to appoint to boards and commissions. So she kind of started trying to make those appointments. They shot them down one by one. I don't think very many of them got through. Eventually, they removed her appointment powers. Some other things that she did, they kind of claimed that she kept making false accusations against the city or against city council members. So one thing was that she claimed that they were discriminating against her because of her gender, because she's a woman. And then the council went and took that and said, well, we're not going to take that lightly. They discussed it in closed session, and then they went and hired an outside firm for $4,000 or something like that and said everything, you know, came back fine, nothing happened. So they kind of said, she keeps making accusations, we spend needless money, and that pattern kept kind of continuing. She argued that she was, you know, just passing along concerns she heard from the public, and then the council would take it too far and then do this whole investigation and that sort of thing. She would also talk to city staff directly, which you're supposed to go through the city administrator, according to the city administrator, and she tried to form a bunch of committees, one allegedly supposed to be to look into Muscatine's form of government, which you can see why the council would not like that. So that was kind of the pattern over the whole, you know, really it was just a year. And then eventually they kind of started the process of removing her from office.
And they took they had plenty of hours of hearings at City Hall, didn't they, to and eventually what, voted unanimously to remove her from office?
Yeah, so under Iowa code, they could have either taken the case directly to district court in the first place, which they, it's very rare that they have a split vote in Muscatine City Council, and it was 4-3, and they voted to do it in-house at the council chambers. And so then they hired retired Judge John Nara to be prosecutor and held 2 days, 20 hours worth of removal hearings. The mayor testified for herself on the second day and only called one witness. But it was kind of an airing of the city's dirty laundry. So many city officials spoke at it. And then in May, as you said before, they voted unanimously to remove her. It was a 3-minute meeting, no discussion, and then she was out of the office. Mm. And then she immediately appealed to district court, where in about a month later, she was reinstated by the judge.
And that happened just this week. So what was the appeal based on that the mayor made, and why did the an appeal that the district court judge agreed with this week?
Yeah. So she was immediately reinstated, and then kind of over the summer, the whole case happened. And that was kind of this argument over these 7 closed session meetings that they held to discuss ongoing litigation. Eventually, the judge ruled those should be used as evidence. So that was kind of used in his ruling as well, which is kind of interesting and rare. Her argument was that they, like you said, they violated her right to due process. They acted as prosecutor, judge, jury, executioner, investigator, you know, every role in the process. Whenever they held the first hearing before she was reinstated, the judge said, you know, well, how can the prosecutor that you hired really be unbiased if the city's paying him? So it was kind of clear in the beginning the way the judge was feeling. Mm-hmm. She argued that, you know, you should have taken this to district court in the first place. You wasted a bunch of taxpayers' money, and you didn't give me a fair trial. And that is eventually, yep, this week on Tuesday, how it was a different district court judge, but he ruled that it was a violation of due process, and that in addition to them intermingling the functions of judge, jury, prosecutor, and all that, that they also, he found through the closed session meetings that they had a personal interest in her being removed, partly because she was making these accusations against them, and probably some personal bias came out in those meetings as well.
Did a judge ever rule on whether her conduct as mayor rose to the level of, you know, this description of willful misconduct and maladministration of office?
Yeah, exactly. It did not touch that at all. Of course, the mayor says her conduct did not rise to that level, that, you know, it wasn't justified. But because, yeah, she filed a writ petition, and so that really just was about the process and the procedure. And so he didn't even touch her conduct. And, of course, now the city's released some statements, and that's kind of what they're nailing in everybody's head, is that, you know, she still could be, you know, guilty of these certain things that they're claiming, but the judge didn't go over it at all.
Wow. And we thought politics in Washington were something to roll our eyes at, huh?
I know. It's been a crazy couple of years and getting some weird national attention. People say if you go to Michigan or somewhere random, people have heard of Muscatine because of this. So, of course, the city's not happy for that bad PR.
How are the residents of Muscatine feeling about this? Also, the waste of money here, right? It's got to be a sour mood because of this, huh?
Yeah, well, that's the biggest thing, is people are extremely upset that, you know, estimates are about $500,000 has been spent.
Wow.
That's not official yet because the city denies every open records request. But that's kind of me adding it up in my head. But yeah, so, you know, they're mostly mad about that. And the people who are most vocal about this, you know, on Facebook and social media, they seem to be on the mayor's side. I think they, you know, are upset that they didn't get to watch the mayor they voted for serve in the capacity they were hoping for. You do hear it's a handful of people who kind of defend the city. But I think most people now at this point can kind of see both sides, see that everybody made bad choices. It shouldn't have gotten to this point, and I think people are just ready to move on.
So any thoughts here on how this will affect the election coming up?
Well, it's definitely a more contested race than previous years. Usually council members, there are three council seats open, and the mayor is up for re-election. She has one challenger, and then all the council seats are contested, which is very rare for Muscatine. Most of the people I've talked to said that they're running because of, you know, the past year and what they've watched. And so it'll be interesting. Everybody's talking about how they want new faces in the council. So we'll see if people actually get out and vote and make their voices heard.
Sarah Ritter of the Quad City Times telling us about a district court judge ruling this week that the city council of Muscatine's removal of the mayor there, Diana Broderson, was a violation of her right to due process. Interesting story. Let's hope Muscatine moves into some better politics in the next couple of years, Sarah.
We hope so. They could appeal. It could still be going on, but it's looking like it's coming to a close.
Okay. Sarah, thanks.
Thanks so much.
It's a News Buzz edition of River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This week in Washington, a University of Iowa physician and scientist who successfully developed new technology to enhance the detection of eye disease in people affected with diabetes took part in two congressional briefings. Dr. Michael Abramoff and his Iowa City-based company IDX joined a panel of companies that were spun out of U.S. Research University. Dr. Michael Abramoff joins me now. He's a University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics ophthalmologist, professor of ophthalmology and biomedical engineering at the University of Iowa. Dr. Abramoff, welcome back to our program.
Yeah, hi. Thanks so much for having me.
I'm very interested in what these briefings were about. One sponsored by the House Committee Caucus on Research and Development, the other on the Senate Competitiveness Caucus. Tell us about the first one, Research and Development. What were they interested in learning from you?
I think it was a very exciting opportunity. Of course, they want to see that tax dollars spent on basic science research are you know, deliver what the hopes are for, which is companies developing new products that benefit patients or, you know, other people in the community, as well as create jobs in different parts of the country. And so, you know, basic science is very exciting in itself, but if it leads to new companies forming and you know, betterment of society in different ways, there were many different companies. We happen to focus on healthcare and diagnostics that benefits everyone. And so I think they really focused on seeing how that works in real life. That was very exciting.
Mm-hmm. Any surprises in your testimony there about what they were most interested in?
No, I think they were excited about the fact that, you know, as I said in the briefing, the technology we developed with this artificial intelligence-based is a diagnostic that does not use human input. It's without a physician. I shouldn't say diagnosis. It detects diabetic retinopathy, which is the main cause of blindness in the U.S. population. And if you detect it early, it's very treatable. And right now, that's just not happening. And so many people are going blind needlessly. I'm a retinal specialist, and I see these patients. And so if they catch that early with this type of technology, many cases of blindness can be prevented. And you know, that happens in primary care, which is where these the people with diabetes are and where they want to be. And so the primary care physician is empowered to find these people and refer them, if necessary, to a retinal specialist like me. So, no, there were no surprises. It was just, you know, they were very excited to hear that this can save healthcare dollars. The whole point of IDX is to increase healthcare productivity, and that means increased productivity means lower cost, and that's really what we need in all the healthcare debates, lower cost.
Describe briefly how artificial intelligence, AI, enters the picture here, so there's no human there? How does that happen in the detection of eye disease?
So before I continue, I have to say that right now it's approved in Europe, and so we export there, but it's not cleared by FDA, and I have to be very careful there. We hope for clearance early next year. We finished the clinical trials and test it. How it works is that artificial intelligence is really a complex word for machine learning or, you know, very smart algorithms or computer programs that can detect disease. And in this case, what we have here at IDX is a smart retinal camera. So what happens is that at primary care, the person with diabetes, who doesn't know whether he has a diabetic retinopathy or not, has a few images taken off the back of the eye. That's very quick and painless. And then an algorithm looks at these images and every pixel in this digital image to see whether there's some form of disease there. And it takes about 20 seconds. And then you have a result, which either tells you, well, this is all good, and come back next year. At least your eyes are really good and take care of your diabetes. Or it tells you, well, there's something wrong here. You have diabetic retinopathy in some form, and you need to see a retinal specialist. And then that primary care physician takes a decision to send the patient over to, you know, for example, ophthalmology department.
Is artificial intelligence in this case always right?
No, it will never always be right, and nor are physicians always be right. I have to say that in terms of catching disease, it's better than me. I'm a, you know, fellowship-trained retinal specialist, and I think I take good care of my patients. But in comparisons to retinal specialists, these algorithms do better, both in terms of catching disease when it is there and also in saying, no, there's no disease, when actually this patient doesn't have disease. So, no, it is not. It will never be perfect. But compared to any physician, it's better.
Okay, so just like a few years ago, we had the computers beat humans in chess, and will forevermore do that, we assume they're going to become better and better at evaluating patients' diseases.
Yeah, so and it's always, you know, routine tasks. So, you know, I will not say they're replacing physicians in any way. In fact, you know, you still need a physician for the, you know, the treatment of the disease. But yes, these algorithms are getting better and better for very specific tasks, so I want to be careful with that. And it's exciting because actually IBM Watson made a partnership with us, that is the company behind the winner of Jeopardy, Big Blue, and so they made a partnership with us a few months ago, and they asked us to essentially do all diagnostics for the eye. So everything that you see from IBM Watson that has to do with the eye and diagnosis is actually coming from an Iowa company called IDX.
Fascinating. We have to go. Hope we'll talk again. Fascinating work. Dr. Michael Abramoff of the University of Iowa. We appreciate your time.
Thanks so much. It was very exciting to be on.
And finally, on this News Buzz edition of River to River, a scary story, but with a happy ending from Northwest Iowa. Spencer, where a high school homecoming king has returned to school after collapsing due to cardiac arrest at a football game a few days ago. Tim Gallagher is with us, the Sioux City Journal columnist. Hi, Tim.
Hi, how are you, Ben?
I'm great. We've got about 5 minutes. This is an interesting story. Take us back first to the Spencer football game, October 13th. What happened to Austin Crew? And we mentioned Austin, senior class president, outstanding student with many honors. What happened?
Mm-hmm. Well, he's also a big fan of his high school football team. So Austin went with two buddies down to Storm Lake from Spencer. Spencer won a dramatic 17-14 district contest that night, and the students who were from Spencer at the game, they rushed the field after the game to celebrate with the team and did kind of a victory lap around the track. And then Austin and his two friends went out to Austin's car. They were going to make a pit stop at Taco John's before heading home, but Austin didn't get there. He collapsed as he got into his car, went into sudden cardiac arrest. Thankfully, there was a nurse anesthetist, hard for me to say, Dale Kroll from Spencer, who was there, also a Spencer High School teacher. Jason Holt was on the scene, as was an OB nurse from Storm Lake, but the family doesn't know exactly who that is yet. They started doing CPR as Austin's buddies called his parents and called 911, and within 3 to 4 minutes, paramedics were on the scene, as was a Storm Lake police officer.
Mm-hmm. That's the sense I get from your story, is that really that people knew CPR, they could treat him quickly, and that he could get first responders to him, eventually what, airlifted to Sioux Falls, then to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics.
That's right. He went to Sioux Falls that night, airlifted, and then on Monday, 2 days later, was flown with his mother to the University of Iowa Hospitals in Iowa City. And at that time, there was kind of a wave of cyclonism that overtook Northwest Iowa. Austin is a huge Iowa State Cyclone fan, and his tradition is after each big win that the Cyclones have on the football field, he wears cardinal and gold to school on Monday. And word got out, traveled via social media, and much of the Spencer student body donned cardinal and gold that following Monday, but as did students at Emmitsburg, Spirit Lake, Clay Central Everly, and a few other Northwest Iowa high schools to show their support for Austin Crew.
Mm-hmm. Quickly, his mother, you interviewed her, and it sounds like she thought Austin was not going to make it at some points.
She didn't. He did not have a great go of it at Sioux Falls, but he did eventually was stable enough to be transported to Iowa City, where cardiologists diagnosed him with left ventricular non-compaction cardiomyopathy.
Mm.
Basically, what that means is that when he was in the womb growing before birth, the bottom portion of his heart did not quite solidify as it does for others. So it's kind of a soft, porous mass.
You interviewed him about this. Actually, we have a little bit of tape from Austin Crew explaining that this is actually his thank you, I think repeated to you, Tim, that he gave over the PA, the intercom at his high school, I think, right?
That's right. Tuesday morning, he returned to school, and he delivered this message, a portion of it, to the student body.
Let's listen.
I have a genetic heart condition that is called left ventricular non-compaction cardiomyopathy. This basically means the heart didn't form quite right before I was born. Normally, the heart tissue hardens to a muscle, but mine remains spongy, you know, what they call it, trabeculated. I had an implantable cardioverter defibrillator, or ICD, placed, which can deliver a shock to my heart if it ever stops again. And my cardiologist will be monitoring my heart for other changes that could develop over time. In the meantime, I'm on medicine to help my heart beat stronger, and I can gradually return to physical activity. And I know that you guys had a lot to deal with this past week. I want you to know that I appreciate all of your support and more than words can express. I felt overwhelmed by all the prayers, the cards, the posts and the tweets, and the fact that you all wore cardinal and gold for me, even you Hawkeye fans. And finally, I want to encourage everyone to learn CPR. I personally have never taken CPR, but I'm now going to take a course in case I can save someone else's life. Because my doctors told me even doing something is better than doing nothing, so we can all learn to take CPR. So thanks again, and I'm really glad to be back.
Okay, Austin Crew there. His thanks. Oh, wow. What a story here. And it's interesting, too, when he was at the University of Iowa Children's Hospital. This is the big hospital that overlooks Kinnick Stadium there. There, he and his family really showed their appreciation to the University of Iowa Hospitals and Clinics, I understand, by getting into the Hawkeye spirit while in Iowa City.
Yeah, Austin's older brother goes to Iowa State. Austin's parents are Iowa State graduates. That is where Austin sees himself going to school in the fall. But all of them did what they could. They donned the black and gold for the University of Iowa for a picture to show their thanks to the cardiologists in Iowa City.
Mm-hmm. So what is the outlook for Austin here in 30 seconds? I understand you write in the article he has to stand by a smart box each evening?
He does. He downloads data from his heart, this machine that's in his heart, and it goes to cardiologists. He'll have to see doctors every 6 weeks in the short term. Long term, you know, one day he might need a heart transplant. They don't know for sure. In the future, the family is paying it forward by taking some of the funds that they have been given through these various community fundraisers. They're making a donation to Spencer Municipal Hospital to get started more CPR training for the community.
All right. And, yeah, the community raised several thousand dollars for Austin, another facet of this scary story with such a happy ending. Well, thanks for reporting on this, Tim Gallagher of the Sioux City Journal, columnist there. And you know what? We're going to do right by Austin Crew, if he's listening. We're going to go out with the Iowa State University fight song here.
Okay. And he will be there. He will be there tomorrow as the Cyclones play TCU.
All right. What a story. Tim Gallagher, Sioux City Journal columnist. Thanks for joining us live, Tim.
Thanks, Ben. Have a great weekend, everyone.
You too. River to River is produced by Emily Woodbury, Ben Stanton, and Lindsay Moon, with help from Robbie Broad. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us. Have a warm, wonderful weekend.